Hey everyone, this is Tom Salami of Device Talks. Welcome back to Device Talks Weekly. Another fantastic episode coming your way. A little later in the program, I'll talk with Jen Jun. He's the CEO and founder of Noah Medical. Noah is one of the more interesting surgical robotics companies out there, taking on some big players in a really competitive space, but they think have a true value add and they've got plans for more. So I know you'll enjoy that conversation. Just before that, you'll hear from Sonia Valdez of MedMark. She's going to be talking about what tariffs can mean for MedTech. MedMark has a great perspective on medical device manufacturing. And Sonia, I think, really delivers and gave me some stuff to think about as to the impact that tariffs and modernization of manufacturing can have on MedTech going forward. But of course, we'll kick everything off with my conversation with Mass Devices editor Chris Newmarker, my old pal. So we'll roll into the Newmarker's Newsmakers. Before we do, I wanted to invite you to join us next week for our virtual event. It's called Materials and Manufacturing. It's a three-day episode, and each day is going to take a look at a different technology. So we'll kick off Tuesday. I'll be speaking with Carolina Aguilar from InBrain, and we'll talk about graphene and how InBrain is employing graphene with its BCI device. That's on Tuesday at noon. On Wednesday at noon, I'll be having a conversation with Ryan Stanfield. He's Vice President of Engineering and Operations at Foldax. We had Ken Charhut, the CEO of Foldax, on the program a little bit ago, and Ryan will sort of break down with and provide a really really fantastic presentation. Got to see it yesterday. Just very cool technology. Lots of great illustrations and tech. So if you like cool stuff like that, you definitely want to register. And then finally, you can join us on Thursday. And I had another great conversation yesterday with Timo Latonen. He's the Chief Technology Officer of BioRetech. And of course, we had BioRetech CEO on a bit ago as well. We will unpack BioRetech's bioabsorbable orthopedic material that is used for screws and other orthopedic implants. So we'll understand their story and understand their technology. So it's 3 days spent on three very cool technologies slash materials. Foldax, of course, as a polymer for its heart valves and a robotic manufacturing procedure. So lots of interesting conversations, and I hope you'll join us. It's free. You can watch live and get your questions answered. I'll be hosting all three episodes, or you can watch on demand when it's convenient to you. We won't be able to answer your questions, but you will benefit from everyone else's curiosity. So it's a win-win whether you watch live or watch on demand. Once again, starting Tuesday, November 18th at noon Eastern, we'll be getting together again on Wednesday at noon Eastern and then Thursday at noon Eastern. So go to devicetalks.com to register for that. All right. No more talk from me other than my conversation with Chris Newmarker for the upcoming Newmarker's Newsmakers. Let's get this podcast started. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
How are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well. My gosh, we're talking Wednesday this week, and last night, I mean, man, there were some northern lights in the sky.
You know, I missed it again. No. I saw some stuff on Facebook, like, later on. I probably could have gone out. But could you see them, or could you only see them, like, through your iPhone?
I saw them. I saw red in the sky.
Really? Oh, all right.
In Minneapolis, yeah. I mean, I put my phone camera on, and it's like, woo! But, I mean, even just with my naked eyes, it was like, oh, wow, there's, like, red glowing in the sky and, like, green bands of stuff. And
yeah, no, there's some folks that posted stuff at the lake, which is, like, less than a mile from my house, and it was like, oh, my God, I can't believe that's how the lake looked. And they're like, well, it was my iPhone. You couldn't really see it with the naked eye. I'm like, well, you know, that's cool. It was a great photo, but it's only a photo in my opinion. Like, you really need to see them as you did to see them. Like,
with my own eyes, I saw them.
And otherwise, it's like watching a documentary, like saying you were in the Serengeti because you watched National Geographic. Like, no. Like, you got to see them with your own eyes.
Am I wrong? Am I too strange?
There's a difference between watching the lion on TV and having the lion like near your Jeep and going like, I don't think it's going to drag me out of it. But,
but in case it does, keep rolling. Keep rolling the cell phone. We want to get that out on Instagram. We want as many. Get that out on the TikTok. Get as many views as possible.
Look, it's device. It's a Mass Device Editor Chief Chris Newmarker being eaten by a lion. This is entertainment, people.
That's right. On the good news, Chris has never had such engagement on social media. Yeah,
he's never.
The bad news.
Might be. Well, yeah. There's some. He's getting way more medical care than he was bargaining for.
All right. We're being crazy. Let's get to the new market.
Crazy, man.
That's a big story. Big stories.
Yeah, a lot of big stories. Wow. Yeah, the news has been rolling out. It's just, it's amazing. Like a lot going on. Number five on the list. This was from last week. This is by senior editor Sean Hooley. But we've got Synchron raising a $200 million Series D, and you know we've been covering them for years. And you've had Synchron officials at Device Talks events. I mean, just really, really interesting technology at Stentrode, like kind of having a stent delivered BCI, so you've got like all of this, you know, experience that you know MedTech has with, you know, like catheter delivery systems, like in the cath labs, and then you've got, you know, this being like a BCI that's kind of like a stent based brain computer interface, and so yeah, at this point, Synchron's total funding is $345 million.
That's. I was going to use the word insane, and it's not insane. It's great. It's remarkable that they've raised that much money. Particularly because, you know, this is not a commercialized yet technology for anybody, but just shows you what the potential is. And I think was it last week we talked about the BCI for cancer?
Yeah, BCI for cancer, yeah.
So, I don't know. It feels like we're just opening some door to a whole room full of opportunities.
Room for opportunities, and I mean, and yeah, you have like a company like Neuralink, because it's like got so much, you know, backing from Elon Musk, like they get so much attention. But I mean, Synchron, and we've even had analysts in the past say that Synchron has been one to really watch in this space, and just having that catheter, you know, delivery, you know, system idea, like a stent based PCI, is just a really cool idea.
I saw a post for an internship for at Neuralink for robotics, and I started reading the description.
Interesting, yeah.
And I was like,
they have a robot.
They do. And I was like, is this like a Doc Octopus situation where they're gonna have this robot that's controlled by your mind, but it's actually the robot to implant the Neuralink? I was a little disappointed. I liked my version better, but it seems more responsible what they're doing.
Now I have some picture in my head of like Elon Musk turning into Doc Ock. Just kind of like,
you know what?
Like, wow.
Moving on to number four.
Yeah, we're just going to stop. Yeah, let's not talk about this anymore. Number four on the list. We got BCIs and artificial intelligence. Like, ooh, anyway, yes. Yeah, woo. So we got. It really shows what kind of nerds we are that we get so excited.
Huge nerds.
Awesome, you know. But we got like InBrain Neuroelectronics. They've entered into a strategic collaboration with Microsoft to explore, you know, packaging, you know, in artificial intelligence with, you know, with the next generation brain computer interface therapeutics that they're working on. So, like, just, I mean, just. Great idea. I mean, a lot of, I mean, artificial intelligence right now, so much attention for that technology. And it's, you know, Microsoft, of course, a major player in that space. So, yeah, really interesting to see what they'll do with InBrain.
Yeah. And I don't know if you're, well, this is also by senior editor Sean Hooley. I don't know if you're throwing me up a promotional softball here, Chris, but we will have InBrain CEO Carolina Aguilar on our materials and manufacturing Device Talk Tuesday's series next week. We'll be talking with her about graphene.
Fantastic.
They're very cool material. to that's used for the BCIs, and they are working with Microsoft, and they also have a deal with Merck, one of the Mercks. I know there's two Mercks. One of them, I can't remember which one it is, but InBrain is making a lot of inroads in this space. And I just want to make sure I give you the right date, because we have three events. We've got, Carolina will be on Tuesday, noon Eastern, talking about graphene. Then on Wednesday, we'll have someone from Foldax. Of course, we've had CEO Ken Charhut on the podcast before, talking about their polymer, the new polymer they have for heart valves and the robotic manufacturing system. And then on Thursday, we will talk with the chief technology officer of BioRetech, which, of course, we had their CEO on the podcast a couple of months ago, talking about the next generation of absorbable materials for orthopedics. So,
Sean has a lot of that in their article about like how like their graphene's kind of like this big enabling technology for their like this like super thin, flexible electronic cortical interface that they've created. So I mean that's gonna be great to have her on there, you know, to talk about like, you know, basically their experiences with graphene.
Absolutely. So looking forward to that conversation. Folks can register at devicedocs.com and watch it free or on demand. Watch it live or on demand. It's free either way. But if you watch live, you can get questions answered. So make sure you watch. Join us on noon on Tuesday.
I teed that up all for you, man.
Thank you so much.
You're all good.
That was great. All right.
Anytime.
What's number three, Chris Neumarker?
Hey, number three on the list. Another one from Sean. Sean's staying busy on Mass Device. We have Aspire is getting a class action complaint, from investors over how they disclosed challenges around the rollout of their next gen Inspire. Inspire 5 therapy, Inspire 5. I think it's Inspire 5. It's a V, like a Roman numeral 5.
Yes.
We've seen this happen with other companies. Like, you know, there's bad news and you get these class action suits saying that there was, you know, basically failure to communicate in some way, you know. And so we'll see how this works out for Inspire. I mean, definitely they've been a really exciting company, around here in, you know, the Twin Cities where I'm based. So, we'll see how this works out.
Yeah, I thought this was going to be some sort of activist investor, but the investor is the City of Pontiac, Michigan, Reestablished General Employees Retirement System.
Yes. Yeah. You usually get these types of lawsuits, like, you know, they're filed by like a big, like kind of like one of these big institutional investors. Yep. And then, you know, the lawyers are going class actions, you know, status, you know, and looking to line up other shareholders like in the suit. So, we'll see how it plays out.
And you reached out to, or Sean reached out to Inspire, and they did not comment. So
yeah, Inspire did say they intend to vigorously defend themselves on the matter. So they're definitely contesting the accusations in this lawsuit. So. Number two on the list. This is from yours truly.
Another legal matter.
Another legal matter. Basically back in September, I wrote about, you know, Zimmer Biomet was suing Deloitte over what they called a disaster of a enterprise resource planning software project. This was one of this story is like one of the top stories on Mass Device this year. That story from September has been, widely viewed. I think it's just because I suspect in some ways, I mean, every like really large medical device company and many other companies have to deal with enterprise resource planning software. So, you know, having a company like Zimmer Biomet, accuse Deloitte and like run through this whole story of how, you know, things went, they claim that things went off the rails with this ERP implementation. I suspect it was a cautionary tale for people in a lot of other companies. And they're, you know, it's like you're reading that article, like, or perhaps, you know, other people are like, gosh, we've, you know, we've had our own implementations in the past that were, that, you know, got tough. But I mean, Zimmer Biomet, like in their own earnings, had, you know, last year with Q3 and 2024, had, you know, said that, like kind of the, like what they said was like this botched ERP system implementation, you know, was causing them to reduce their full year guidance last year. So just, you know, just a lot of attention to this case. And then, you know, I saw that, you know, Deloitte, just, on November 7th filed to have the case dismissed. And, you know, so now you can go to Mass Device and, you know, and see like basically Deloitte's side of, you know, this whole legal dispute. And, kind of interesting that Deloitte lawyers decided to get literary with their, if you follow 19th century British children's literature at all, I mean, they were, saying that. Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, got all the Alice in Wonderland books and whatever, you know, anyway, but they said this was a through the looking glass version of Zimmer Biomet had a through the looking glass version of their relationship with Deloitte. And, you know, so they're like kind of going through all the points with, you know, what Zimmer said. So we'll definitely keep on following this case as it plays out. And, the Supreme Court of the state of New York and Manhattan. So it's a case people are watching in our industry.
Absolutely. All right. Let's roll on to number one, Chris Neumarker. Not a good news here, unfortunately.
Yeah. We're definitely isn't a cheery Neumarker's newsmakers this week.
no, it's not.
No.
Started off strong, but it's just kind of...
I know. We started out with like, they raised money. They're partnering with Microsoft. And it's like lawsuit. And now we got like huge layoff. We got Olympus announcing that they're going to be cutting 2,000 jobs. You know, company-wide, you know, they had a headcount of over 29,000, you know, that they disclosed March 31st. So if that's pretty much been in place, that's about a 7%, you know, cut. But we've been, you know, talking actually in previous newsmakers about how Olympus was hitting new milestones under CEO Bob White. But, you know, they're also really engaging in kind of like re-strategizing, refocusing the business and, you know, making workforce cuts is, you know, part of this, you know, like, in fact, Bob White, you know, was in his, in the news release announcing this layoffs, like talked about, you know, the need to simplify the organization. So enhance agility. So this is, unfortunately part of that.
All right. Well, these things do happen with new management in place, but never good to hear folks losing their jobs. So hopefully they'll be reabsorbed quickly in this market, which is, I don't know, we need to take a broader, a closer look, I guess, at the state of the medtech market. We're obviously seeing, I think, some layoffs a little too frequently. But
Yeah, we've been seeing, I mean, there's been kind of like this steady stream of layoffs going on in recent years. On the flip side, there's companies that are bright spots. I mean, you see companies like Boston Scientific, you know, that's, you know, really, you know, steaming forward. So, I mean, I we were kind of debating this earlier, like, that is, you know, medtech, I think overall, historically, medtech has been more recession-proof. I think the pandemic was an exception to the rule, but you also had a good point. We have a lot of insurance cuts right now. We have...
Yeah, I mean, you got cuts to Medicaid, you got higher deductibles, you got folks who are going without care that they need because they just have to pay out of pocket and they don't have it. So we certainly are recession-proof. I mean, healthcare never goes, quote-unquote, out of style, but, you know, I guess it depends how you measure the impact that a recession would have. Certainly, we're not impervious to economic downturn. So
yeah,
we'll see. And then the tariffs, as we'll have in our FOMO episode this week, we'll understand a bit more about how tariffs can impact companies and add a lot more cost to manufacturing. Certain times.
MedTech seems more U.S. based than a lot of other industries. Yep. I mean, so
that's what Scott Whitaker made that point at AdvaMed for sure.
Yeah. So yeah. I mean, and you know, I can, it's unscientific, but even where I live here in the Twin Cities, I mean, driving around, I see so many of like this whole ecosystem of contract manufacturers and OEMs like making stuff here, like in the West Metro of Minneapolis. And I know you see the same thing in the Boston area, you know, but yeah, at the same time, I mean, okay, I guess, I mean, if somebody needs a new heart valve, they're going to get a new heart valve, whether they can find the money or not. If you need a new knee, I mean, that might depend. Like, it might depend on how bad that knee is, and maybe you wait, you know. So, I mean, it's an interesting situation right now. But we'll just keep on covering the news and providing the information to everybody, and you know, keep everybody updated on, you know, where things are going.
Absolutely. And speaking of new heart valves, make sure you join us Wednesday on Device Talks Tuesdays when we'll. Talk with Ryan Stanfield, the VP of Engineering Operations from Foldax. So
there we go.
Was that smooth? Was that slow?
Wow, what a transition, yeah, right in there, man. Woo. If people don't know, Tom does webinars. He does. It's not just podcasts.
You not just podcasts. Know, no.
Exactly.
No. Like, I get on camera too sometimes.
Live events sometimes, right? We got a
sometimes,
few live events.
Once in a while. Three times a year, we'll
That's
be
right.
In fact, we'll be in Minnesota on May 4th and Boston on May 27th, 28th. And we'll be
Fantastic.
Back west next year. But no, seriously, yeah. To all let's hope things hold steady for layoffs from here on in. And I mean, a new CEO comes into a company, they make changes, they move things around. Redundancies are created. And then hopefully they reinvigorate another med tech business. So hopefully that's
exactly. Hopefully that's happening because I mean, there definitely seems to have been some there up until this. There's been a decent amount of positive energy coming out of Olympus. It seems since Bud White took over, you know, over there, you know. But yeah, always tough to hear of like a major layoff like that. And I don't know about you, but I actually know. I mean, I've noticed you, Tom, you've been really good when you notice, you know, and I'm the same way. We, you know, with our big LinkedIn following, we notice people are announcing that they're hiring and that they're getting new jobs. Like, we, you know, we really try to like that, you know.
Yeah, I try
that,
to share
and
those.
Kind of spray the word. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So hopefully we can help in our own tiny way. But
exactly.
All right, Chris Neumarker, way to bring everybody down. Nice going.
Sorry, just almost as depressing as being a New York Giants fan.
And you went this whole time without mentioning the Ohio State Purdue game. So
you know, I thought I'd leave you alone. We'll see how Ohio State does against Michigan or, you know, Indiana, like down the road. So that'll be good.
I don't know who Purdue fans will root for in Ohio State versus Indiana because. There is a very strong cross-state rivalry. Just like Red Sox fans chant Yankee sucks, apparently.
Is there something they trade? Like when Purdue plays Indiana, is there like some
object
that
they get? Oh, that's a good
question.
There is. I knew they have something with, I think, the University of Illinois. Like they got a statue of a cannon,
that's great.
Like the Cannon Cup or something. So.
Yeah, we have a cup. Ohio State too has a cup with Illinois, and then actually Minnesota and Wisconsin. It's Paul Bunyan's axe. Right.
Of course,
whoever wins the game gets Paul Bunyan's axe.
All right, Chris Neumarker.
Fantastic. All right, good times, Tom. Talk soon.
All right, Chris Neumarker, thanks for the newsmakers. Now let's hear our FOMO, Future of MedTech Opportunities, conversation with MedMark. Hi, everyone. This is Tom Salemi. I am here with Sonia Valdez, Vice President for Claims at MedMark. Sonia, thank you so much for joining us on FOMO.
Thank you, Tom.
So we're going to unpack an important issue today. We're going to look at supply chain and all the issues that are related to that. Give us, though, a sense, give our listeners a sense, where MedMark sort of fits into helping MedTech clients with supply chain issues. What is your role in all of that?
Sure. MedMark was created in 1979 by companies who had trouble getting insurance. They were medical device companies. And so they created MedMark to handle their product liability needs. And so we have grown throughout the years, now underwrite any type of medical device from the most serious to the most innocuous. We write underwrite clinical trials, drug companies, generics, over-the-counter, the entire array of life sciences companies are our clients. Supply chain issues are very important. Mm-hmm. We live in a global economy. Manufacturing for our medical devices and our generics companies are often take place overseas. And so some of the situation, the geopolitical situations that we are seeing now have a tremendous effect on their ability to produce their products.
So give us a sense then from MedMark's perspective of sort of the state of supply chain. We obviously read a lot in the papers and are talking to professionals out there who are dealing with challenges firsthand. There is a lot of going on and a lot of things that need to be overcome. What are you seeing as someone who's in touch with the medical device industry as closely as you are?
Very much concerned over where this manufacturing is going to take place. Over 90 countries are facing tariffs from the current administration, with China having the highest rate of tariffs. We have many contract manufacturers in China who have the sophistication and have the experience and relationship with us over the years. We're going to have to probably move those manufacturing facilities to other places. And that is not going to be cheap or easy. The whole goal of the current tariff situation is to move manufacturing back to this country. That will take, being very ambitious, 3 to 5 years and a lot of money. And it's going to be a lot of money in terms of startups, but also American labor is going to be much more expensive than the labor in these other countries that have been we've used to make our products.
As an insurer of medical devices and a protector of medical device companies, what challenges is MedMark seeing specifically as related to supply chain?
Well, what we see in my world every day are product defect cases. And so the more hands that touch your product, mm-hmm. the more chance there is for risk. The risk being a defect in your product. When you shift suppliers, it's not that easy to make the product that you want necessarily. It takes quite a bit of startup to learn what the product should be and how it should come out. And so we are very concerned about our products lacking the quality control that we have seen in the past. And also the shortages of these particular products. You know, shifting from one supplier to the other takes time. And so it's not just the whole product, it's also component parts and raw materials that need to be replaced. And raw materials are particularly important. You can't shift raw materials that quickly. The other aspect of it, if you shift raw materials, looking at it from the life sciences, the FDA doesn't go in and check raw materials manufacturers. So you better make sure that they are compliant, that they are not contaminated. And that is not an easy thing to start up, to make sure.
Interesting. I mean, we hear the conversations and the hopes, or at least the objectives of moving manufacturing, I guess, elastically, or at least nearer our shores. You have, I think, probably a closer perspective than a lot of people and all the challenges that may come with the objective of the tariffs. And you're talking again to a lot of med tech companies. Do you see them having plans to do some of this onshoring? Do you see them sort of waiting and kind of throwing their hands up at this point? What's the feel of the industry, if you don't mind sharing that?
Sure. I will start off by saying we are definitely in a global economy, and I want to give you an example of what I mean. I had a horrible death case involving a child. It involved an AmbuBag that didn't work the way it was supposed to. And this was about 10 years ago. The material for the AmbuBag was some kind of rubber from Malaysia. It was principally manufactured in China and assembled in Latin America for sale in the United States. And what happened was one of the valves to be used was not made correctly. And so therefore, this particular child was not getting the air that he needed because he had an obstruction as a result of a tonsillitis that went bad. And so the child died. So where did the mistake come in? Did it come in at where the Chinese were manufacturing it, or did it come in Latin America assembly for use in this country? So tracking these product defects is going to be a big concern for the future as we continue these global manufacturing practices.
And is that something that you're hearing from clients as well? Are they confident that they're coming up with plans that will, without naming names, but just broadly, plans that will help meet these objectives? Or is there sort of a broader uncertainty as to where, how we'll be able to meet those objectives?
I think it's going to be uncertainty. The cost of reshoring these companies that have done most of their manufacturing overseas, I read an estimate the other day, is going to be $1.2 trillion,
wow,
which will mostly to consumers. About 70% of that $1.2 trillion is going to come out of the consumer pockets as high prices. So I think it's going to come back to this country in some form. And I think ultimately you're looking at safer products. Although I will say that the future of manufacturing is going to be AI, robotization, mm-hmm, and digitalization. And that is going to actually lower the cost of manufacturing of these medical devices.
How do you view the additions of these technologies? Is this still, do you see hope that it's going to make things safer and more predictable to manufacture, or does new technology come with new uncertainty?
New technology always comes with new uncertainty, but I do believe that the AI, the data will optimize productivity. And you know what we're working towards in the manufacturing is virtual factories here, mm-hmm, in the United States, because it's going to be an expensive solution coming back to manufacturing this thing. Some companies are not going to do it. What they're going to do is try and optimize processes overseas using AI. For example, building a virtual manufacturing facility here in the United States to control what's going on in the overseas plant. Mm. And that gives me great hope, because you can run data to suggest, for example, AI can tell you when a particular product needs maintenance. It could tell you when a product is conforming to the way it's supposed to be. And then there are robots that will ultimately be performing the more dangerous jobs in these manufacturing facilities.
So looking forward, how do you see things playing out in the next 5 to 10 years? What do you see our medical device manufacturing world looking like?
I see tremendous capital investments in AI and a lot of robotization, digitalization processes and applications in order to optimize productivity.
Interesting. And I would think that would be accelerated by this sort of tumultuous change to the manufacturing. If folks are required to build new, then they're probably going to build these, they're going to skip a generation of plants and build the newest type of plant they can. Do you see that sort of kind of leapfrogging, like almost a rebuilding of a city that has been destroyed by some form or fashion, that we're going to have newer technologies and newer infrastructure?
Right. I mean, this is maybe an unintended benefit of, mm-hmm, the situation. We're going to have uncertainty. We're going to have high costs. We're going to have product shortages. There's no way around it until we catch up and we are able to build these facilities to meet our needs.
What are some other costs associated with moving suppliers, moving manufacturing, creating that uncertainty? What else could impact the medical device industry going forward?
Well, we've talked about capital costs, putting these new suppliers and building these new factories and overseeing and vetting them and certifying them. But not doing this has a huge price in terms of product liability litigation. If your products do not meet the standard, you're looking at becoming a target in product liability litigation. Let's just say your product is short a couple of, and therefore doesn't fit the way it's supposed to for an implantation, or their product is contaminated, doesn't have the right amount of active pharmaceutical ingredient. What happens is you will become a target in American litigation. Mm-hmm. And that could really hurt your bottom line even more than these capital costs.
So these moves that need to be made to change suppliers, to change location of manufacturing, each needs to be done very deliberately and carefully, I would imagine, because anything you do without the proper due diligence certainly exposes you if something goes wrong down the line.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there are things that, you know, our companies can do. They can contractually make sure that the indemnification clauses are very strong in their favor. Mm-hmm. They can make sure that these companies that they are using, their new companies that they're using, have very solid insurance profiles, and that you're not required to pick up anything that they do wrong. You just do not want to become a target in litigation in this country because of the current outlook on these on our American companies are looked as the bad guys.
Fascinating. We follow headlines, we follow big trends, but it's so helpful to hear from folks on the ground who are talking with medtechs and really looking at the impact of this news. Sonia Valdez, thanks for joining us on FOMO.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, thanks again to MedMark for supplying this week's FOMO. Now let's get into our keynote conversation. I spoke with Jun Jun. He's the CEO and founder of Noa Medical. Noa is, I think, one of the more interesting surgical robotics companies out there, taking on some big players in the pulmonary market, but they have their eyes on many more opportunities. So let's hear my conversation with Jun Jun of Noa Medical.
Well, Jun Jun, welcome to the podcast.
Great, Tom. Thanks for inviting me.
My pleasure. We're going to explore the Noa Medical story in a minute. I think it's one of the more interesting surgical robotics plays out there. But we'd love to, of course, learn a bit about our guests and their backgrounds. Jun, what brought you into the medical device industry? Are you a medical device person or a robotics person?
That's a great question. I started as a technologist, more of a robotics person, until my PhD at Columbia, where I joined a medical robotics program. That's my PhD program at Columbia in New York.
Okay.
So that was my transition to more of a med device person.
Excellent. And what was it that drew you to that particular project? Did you want to get involved with medical devices, or was it just a cool application of robotics that that you saw?
Certainly that's very important to me. I don't know whether you know this, could be a fun fact, where my first name, Jian, in Chinese means health. So certainly my parents and my family want me to be healthy, but meantime, they also wanted me to become a doctor.
Oh, okay.
A real physician doctor, not a robotics doctor. So I ended up being a robotics doctor, and then I'm glad I'm able to accomplish the goal for both, doing the robot for the medicine.
That's great. And did you know once you started working on that project at Columbia that this was sort of the path you wanted to follow? Because you've done that since, so something must have resonated.
For sure. I totally enjoy the 5 years I spent at Columbia. I was working on a robot for cochlear implant surgery.
Huh.
And in fact, I actually got job offers for a company who work on cochlear implant after my PhD, another job offer from Intuitive Surgical. So I ended up joining Intuitive as my first job, but that was the start of my real medical device journey in the commercial side.
That's great. And you were at Intuitive for a short time, for only a year or so, before you you moved over to Auris Health. How did that opportunity come to be? And that must have been an exciting time. You were employee number two, so I guess I'm not sure if you were quite a company yet or just sort of a small meeting.
Yeah, that was a interesting transition time. If I may, I can tell you that at Columbia, I was more looking for a job that's relevant to my career, to mm-hmm. my specialty. And then I relocated to Sunnyvale and, immediately got myself immersed in the work at Intuitive where, I was engineer for the Da Vinci Xi laparoscope and work on that a little bit. And then, certainly as a PhD, I was trying to work on many aspects of the robot. But then in the company at that time, Intuitive had about 1,500 people. And certainly I was able to own a key piece in the design, but not enough for a PhD, mm-hmm. in my view. And then I was lucky that, Fred Ma recruited me out of Intuitive to join him on the Auris journey. And then Auris also is a project spinoff from my lab at Columbia many years ago.
Okay.
So there's just a long story there, but there's a correlation between, or there's a connection between Auris, myself, and later on through introductions to Fred Ma.
Oh, okay. I was wondering how you came to know Fred or how he came to know of you and how that all came together. So you were connected with the Auris technology before you were connected with Fred Mahler, or was it simultaneous or
Yeah, what, you know, people probably don't know this, but Oris was incorporated by a group of Android investors from the East Coast. That was prior to 2010.
Okay.
And in fact, the name of Oris, Oris means hearing or ear. You know, these Android investors, they wanted to commercialize the cochlear implant robot I was working on. And I wasn't directly involved in the business side at that time, but I heard the rumor that when Fred Ma came to our lab and visited, you know, the work, look at the work we have, and he was intrigued by the application of the robot in the ophthalmology. It's a small robot, very precise. He was thinking, oh, if I use this for ophthalmology, it will be a much bigger market than cochlear implant. So that's where Fred got involved. And then later on, they relocated the company to California.
I see.
And then later on, I came to Intuitive and then reconnected with Fred and then got put into his new new journey at that time at Oris.
Interesting. And I'm seeing now you actually left Oris a few years before the sale to J&J and all that, correct?
Yeah, Oris had a total of about 8 years from 2011 to 2019 of the acquisition. So I was there for the first 4 years, and I left early 2015.
Okay. And you went to a company that's called Robot Phoenix. You were CEO and co-founder. So this was not a surgical robotic. This was an industrial robot manufacturer. Is that right?
Correct. That was also an interesting opportunity back then because China had a short of labor around that time frame. A lot of young folks have a better life and they don't want to go back to work after you know, being at home through the Chinese New Year. So every New Year, people tend to go back to hometown, but they don't go back to work market again because, you know, the work is tedious and labor is sort of simple labor is not interesting to the young folks. And China was short of labor at that time. And for me, I was more interested in helping resolve the short of labor problem. And also, I saw what happened in Germany and later in Japan and US in terms of automation, you know, replacing labor. And that's a company where I put some money down for my friends a few years ago. But then the business started kind of roll. At some point, you know, I decided to join them. And it was also a good learning opportunity for me too, as a key person later on, because I went back to China. You know, I was you know, with the title CEO. But truthfully, it was a learning opportunity for me to become a business person and also how to operate a business in OUS in China market.
Mm-hmm.
There's a ton of things that I learned on the business side.
Interesting. What was the outcome of that? Did you exit that or you did exit that?
Yeah, it was also very, this conversation brings a lot of good memories. technically, Robot Phoenix was the first company that I was a CEO of, and also, you know, kind of the first company of my own to some extent, because I was early investor of that company. But, you know, the outcome of that business was we were able to get to commercial growth, initial growth. And then, you know, through some sort of interesting conversations between the founders and also the investors, there is a different opinion about where the company should head on strategy in the future. And, you know, because of that different opinion, we were able to, you know, exit through a buyout. So technically speaking, we made some money, but meantime, you know, I wasn't there till the end.
Mm-hmm.
So the company's still around. Actually, they are fighting for IPO in Hong Kong. And
wow,
the company's doing great. I was glad I was the founder of the company and also helping them during the early phase of the growth.
I just want to settle here for a second. I mean, looking, this is a pretty remarkable rise. In 5 years, you went from being sort of an entry level, I think, engineer at Intuitive to the CEO of your own company, which you exited it shortly after. Was that by design? Did you say, I want to do this someday? Or did you just keep on saying yes to new opportunities?
It's a good one because I always wanted to become an entrepreneur since my high school. And I was keeping my ears open. But meantime, I have to tell you, once I relocated to the Silicon Valley with the opportunity at Intuitive, I got more exposures to the startup environment and also the community with investors. I think, honestly, that the bar to become a CEO of a startup company is quite low, or the founder of a startup company is quite low in the Silicon Valley. So if you are willing to take the risk, you can always start a company anytime. but the hard part is not about starting. It's about the growing and sustaining and longevity. So that's kind of what we're working on. But I've been dreaming to become an entrepreneur. I've been dreaming to follow my parents' lead and try to do things that are adventurous.
That's amazing. So you had a year off in there. I love the title of Thinker Strategizer Transit Co. I love the name Transit Co. This is on your LinkedIn profile. But then your next stop, and I'm sorry to keep kind of going through the laundry list, but CEO of AccuView. This is not a robotics company. This is a Hysteroscope. Is it Hysteroscope? Am I saying that correctly?
Hysteroscope.
Hysteroscope. Thank you. is that how did you come? So this is more of a pure medical device play.
Exactly. All these things kind of happen for a reason. The part I learned with the China business was in RoboPhoenix, we built capital equipment. We built robots for manufacturers. Mm-hmm. Several of the known names are our customers, for example, P&G and things like that. And what I found as a business person in that first try was that when I save some money for the manufacturer as an automation provider, let's just say they save a dollar, and they're not going to give, 80 cents to us, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to keep the 80 cents saving and give us 20 cents as a manufacturer or automation provider. So that, from the business side, that tells me that automation, there's a value for sure, but we're going to have to share the value with the customer. And for that part, automation doesn't necessarily have an edge to charge a premium.
Hmm.
Now, in my transition of the few months that took time off and really reflected on what should I do next and what else do I wanted to learn and do more. This opportunity at AccuView attracted me because, there was a founder and he also just closed the Series A. He's one of my senior alumni. And this guy is talking about turning Hysteroscopes or reusable, durable, these endoscopes into single-use endoscopes for gynecology use. So for me, it was eye-opening because certainly I'm familiar with endoscopes because mm-hmm. I worked on laparoscope at Intuitive, also worked on the endoscope at Auris. I know the technology well. And for us to work on a simple scope for gynecology use, that's not very hard at all from technology side. But meantime, on the business side, there's a ton to innovate, meaning we are changing a capital sale of a scope to a single-use, pay-per-use model and how to produce endoscopes in mass scale and also how to cost down and how to control the quality at scale.
Uh-huh.
I think at that time for me, it was like, oh my God, this is the best opportunity ever because I know the technology well, I can learn something new. And there's also a premium story in healthcare where there is existing reimbursement. There is clear margin on the procedure on the device like this. And we also can leverage production OUS. So that's why I said, okay, I'm willing to join you and become a partner and work on this. And he was generous to let me run the business for the U.S. Division.
Mm-hmm.
So then I joined him and started working on the company at that time.
And AccuView is still around, right?
AccuView is still around.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe now they have a major operation in China as well. And mm-hmm. they're also trying to build more products beside diagnosis.
Interesting. So let's now move into the Noah story. I want to get into how you decided to start the company, but it might be a good time for you to just take a a minute or two to describe NOAA to folks, to let them know what you do.
At NOAA, we are a mission-driven company. We definitely have a lot of technology, but our goal is to build a endoluminal robot platform for diagnosis, treatment, and surgery. And we see our procedures in the future, you know, all NOAA procedures in the future should have no holes on the patient body and should cause minimal bleeding and even no bleeding outside the body. And our patients should be able to go home the same day or next day.
How did you come upon this opportunity? What problem did you see that that needed to be solved, and how did you come up with the solution?
Yeah, this is a great question. So when I started NOAA at second half of 2018, I wasn't thinking necessarily to build a robot. You know, the hard part of the robot is that it's capital intensive. It's also very heavy business from manufacturing quality and distribution service. And also it takes a long time to return investment. And a lot of the medical robot companies are, you know, what we call one trick pony. And, you know, one trick pony with one indication only doesn't necessarily justify the investment easy. So when I started NOAA, I wasn't thinking about building a robot in the second half of 2018. And what I wanted to do at NOAA since the beginning was, hey, can I build a single-use endoscope platform company where I can offer endoscopes that are single-use to other indications outside gynecology? Because actually, we were working on gynecology only. And for me, I was hoping to build a solution for multiple indications. So personally, I looked into about 24 indications back then. You know, there's all kinds of endoscopes. You know, you can see them on the market today. At that time, though, the third of the 24 indications are already single use, mostly led by Embu. A third of them are ready to be converted to be single use. The remainder third are never going to be single use. You know, the remainder third require high resolution, stereo vision, all of that. I don't see them anytime soon to be single use feasible. So I was hoping to demonstrate technologies to large medical device companies. In fact, I talked to probably about 100 medical device companies, large or small, and try to offer an OEM business to them to say, hey, can I build a single-use endoscope for you so that you can use this in your product or in combination with your therapeutic or diagnosis devices? That was the beginning of NOAA. And then fast forward to springtime 2019, Auris got acquired by J&J in February or April 2019. And that was the moment where certainly they made a big splash, and I was lucky to be one of the early employees in, you know, having all the stock and all that stuff. Very, very glad that this happened. But meantime, from the market, though, the users of early Monarch, and, you know, by that time, Monarch users have been using Monarch for a year. The launch of Monarch was March or April 2018. And then later on, in early 2019, Ion published their peer review articles on their first in human study from Australia. So these early robotics users started to ask the question about, hey, what value do these robots actually provide to our clinical practice? Certainly is a new tool. It's a very fancy tool. But what value do they actually bring? The reason they ask that question is that when they look at diagnostic yield, which is a key metric for clinical value, they are seeing very confusing results compared to the prior technology that are non-robot. So this is the starting point of NOAA, where they come to me, and in fact, potential partners came to NOAA and said, hey, you guys want to build a robot instead? Because there's opportunity to make these robots way better, having a higher diagnostic yield and more consistent diagnostic yield and easier to use. So the easier to use is a theme throughout all medical robot companies, because, you know, I still remember early Da Vinci users say it's a great tool, but my procedure is much longer. So how to reduce the procedure time, make the procedure more efficient. And lastly, how to manage or reduce the total cost of ownership of having a robot program.
Okay.
So clinical value, clinical efficiency, clinical cost become the three pillars for us as a entrepreneur or startup company to think about how to enter the market if we are entering it. And that took us a while, and then figure out, okay, these are the things we find out that we can contribute. We can bring a different solution. So really, I would say Noah was built on the opportunity that we ran into with prior technologies don't have, you know, haven't met all the needs from potential physicians and hospitals. So that's how we really started the business back then.
Well, let's expand on that a bit. And maybe if you could also address the earlier on, you said there was some confusing elements of the data that led to questions about the value of the other technologies. What was confusing, and what could you be a little more explicit on what opportunities you see to differentiate Galaxy, Noah Medical's product, from the other products in the area that are frankly manufactured by much larger and I would think more tough competitors for a smaller company like Noah? Where do you see the opening?
So this is an interesting question. I would say early 2019, when we look at the clinical study from Ion in Australia and also the early user feedback of Monarch, you know, the discussion around diagnostic yield has been the focus. And
what is diagnostic yield?
What does that mean?
Yeah.
It's a very scientific word. And in fact, even though I'm a PhD, I still, at the beginning, I couldn't really wrap my head around it.
I feel better.
Yeah. So let me try to answer this in a simple way. I don't know whether this is scientific enough or not, but I think as a common person, I can tell my mom to understand this in this way, the following way. So basically, the hospital has 100 patients, how many of them they can accurately diagnose?
Mm-hmm.
So if they can say 50% diagnostic yield means for 100 patients, you can accurately diagnose lung cancer, 50 patients. The other 50 patients, you got them wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a flip of coin.
Okay.
And the first technology that we heard about prior to robots were what we call navigated bronchoscopy, where people use navigation technology, just like a Google map, to tell you a virtual map to guide the physician to get to lesion and the luminally through the mouth to get to the lung. So those devices generally have a diagnostic yield about high 60s. And robot solutions, the first-gen robot solutions, Monarch and Ion, were able to, through early studies, they were able to show they can get to high 70s.
Okay.
But then the question the doctors asked me in 2019 was, hey, we work with you guys at early days of Auris. We've been telling you we need to be high 80s or low 90s. We need to hover around 90%. How come this thing only get us high 70s?
Mm-hmm.
So it was very puzzling because we all know robot is precise, right? If you look at the history of robot, it used to be robotic technology for orthopedics and neurosurgery where they make a large hole on the body, precise, large hole. Da Vinci did a fantastic job. They did a precise robotic surgery with small holes, either a single port or multi-port, but small holes. The future technology should be robot with precision, but no holes. That's what Noah is doing, right? I think that's where the market is going.
That's great.
But with robot alone, it doesn't improve diagnostic yield enough. That's a puzzling piece. When we dig in, when we peel the onion, then what we found out is physicians were biopsying a targeted lesion using a Google map or a navigated bronchoscopy technology, whether mm-hmm. they use shape sensing or whether they use a magnetic sensor, Monarch and Ion using different technology there for navigation, but both of them are biopsying, physicians are biopsying a virtual ball. The ball used to be a green color. We've been joking about that and say virtual green ball looks good, but that's not the lesion. It's a virtual ball. So it's very simple. If you don't see it, how can you, diagnose or put your needle into your lesion accurately.
Mm-hmm.
And doctors say, no, what are you talking about? We see it. And we ask them, what do you see? They see the green ball. The green ball is not the lesion in the lung because the lung is moving. The CT scan, which used to generate the green ball, it was typically, a couple of weeks old. And, lung is a moving target. So I think that's where the light bulb turns on and say, how can we have physicians see their twin lesion? If they can see two in the lesion, then the chance of being right, being more accurate, must be higher. So that's our working assumption, and we work on proving that for the first couple of years of NOAA history.
Was this a complicated system to come up with? I mean, you've worked on similar products before. What went into the development of Galaxy? How did you arrive at this solution?
Yeah, this is a great question. I think the learning from Intuitive, later Auris, and some of our team member came from other medical robot companies, is that we always wanted to focus on the solution business end. Mm-hmm. So what is solution or business end? It is the end that's touching the lesion or touching the tissue. That's where value is created.
Okay.
It doesn't matter, you know, you use a single arm in the back or two arms or, you know, five arms, and that's not the driver of the solution. The driver of the solution is value creation, which is a tissue piece. From there, you go backwards to drive your back end. So I think for us, when we innovate based on what we've seen in the past, Da Vinci, Mako, Mazor, you know, Corindus, and Hansen, Auris, and all that, we're like, okay, what problem do they actually solve? And how do we solve the lung cancer problem again? That's why we came up with a second generation solution, right? So it's one generation leaping forward compared to what's out there today. And this newer solution really focuses on clinical value, clinical efficiency, and clinical cost.
You initially had said, you talked about surgical robotic solutions being sort of one-trick ponies. This is not that. You see Galaxy as being more than, it's going beyond the lung. This is a bigger picture solution. Talk a bit about the potential for Galaxy, or maybe it'll have another iteration with a different name. I'm not sure. But what is ultimately the vision for where this this robot can go?
Yeah, certainly, you know, the lesson learned there was from prior companies in medical robot space. A lot of them didn't make it. Some did. For the few that did make it to some kind of success, we'll have to define what success means in our space. But we did examine all of them and learned that they are all a technology platform. They can expand across indications. So for us, the most obvious one is lung cancer treatment, right? So imagine one day if I got a lesion in my lung, I was sent to a Galaxy procedure. When I wake up and the doctor said, hey, good news is I found it's a cancer. Bad news is you have to come back here for a lung resection. Uh-huh. I would rather say, hey, wake up and tell me I got a polyp in your colon and then remove the polyp. So you're safe to go home, right? That's what's happening today with colon screening. With lung screening, lung biopsy, that's not the case. The patients have to come back in again to the hospital. And it's more than inconvenience. It's just actual cost to the healthcare system and also additional risk to wait. Because lung cancer progresses really fast inside the body. There's no nerves around the lesion. So the goal would be one day in the future, we'd like to not only diagnose, but also treat in the same case. And we are definitely, you know, making some investment there. And we're trying to make sure that we build a Galaxy platform for, you know, indications beyond lung biopsy.
So right now, is the challenge diagnosing that tissue correctly while the device is inside the patient, or is it the removal of the tissue, or is it both? Are those both things that you need to accomplish?
The first thing is diagnosis or diagnostic yield or mm-hmm. diagnosis accuracy. And without it, there's no foundation to talk about endoluminal cure or endoluminal treatment. So with Galaxy, you know, we start to see consistently around 90% diagnostic yield, strict definition. So again, we're talking about diagnostic yield again. The good news on that is in the past couple of years, within the community, there is a consensus on how diagnostic yield should be defined. And now everybody start to say diagnostic yield, strict definition. So that's a definition NOAA has been using. Mm-hmm. We'll continue to use that standard definition. And with that, we have data to show we are, consistently around 90%.
Interesting. And with that strong diagnosis capability, what goes into the next stage of being able to remove the tissue and just do it all at once? What are the challenges there?
Yeah. So certainly, you know, the second step will be treatment. And, you know, I said earlier, we want to build a platform for diagnosis, treatment, and surgery. Mm-hmm. So there is, in my mind, at least there's a difference between treatment and surgery. Surgery often means surgical resection or surgical removal. Treatment could mean a local cure, mm-hmm. whether through drug delivery or a radiation therapy, or could through some other thermal ablation solutions. So if we are able to catch the cancer early, we are able to locally cure that tissue, or even quote unquote burn the tissue, so that the cancer cell do not grow anymore. Only if you won't be able to catch them early, you can have to wait for later stage organ removal or organ surgery. That's where minimally invasive surgery start to play a big role. And in fact, there's many patients going through that kind of surgery these days.
Interesting. So what is the plan to move into other parts of the body? Do you stay within the lung until you've perfected this and then begin to branch out, or do you have programs looking at how Galaxy can reach elsewhere?
Yeah, we definitely have studied the opportunities outside the lung, and we did market analysis, opportunity assessment, technology evaluation, and things like that. So we do have a portfolio of solutions that we like to explore. But as a startup company, we certainly want to focus on a couple of things. One of them is commercialization growth for mm-hmm. the first indication. And also we are investing in the platform expansion in technology readiness. So those are the sort of two guiding principles for a startup.
What is the commercialization strategy in terms of sales? How are these put into hospitals? Are you selling the systems, or is it a service, or what's the model?
Yeah, we are, in terms of acquisition model, we do sell the capital equipment, and also we sell a procedure kit uh-huh. that is single use, and then we provide a service on the equipment annually. So this is our very typical razor blade model for a medical robot company mm-hmm. that were successful. So we kind of follow the same principles there.
Great. So where do you see the market for these products? Is it largely in large clinical settings? Is there an ASC sort of strategy for this?
Yeah, this is a great question. We understand the whole healthcare is costly, mm-hmm. and there's a major trend of going from main hospital to ASCs or satellite hospitals. I think we are riding that curve as a startup company, showing up with a new technology that's really designed for setups that are, or hospitals with less infrastructure. And, do we go as far as ASC? We certainly have talked about that a lot internally. And, so far, we are still evaluating. That's not our strategic focus. Mm-hmm. And we see our product, as at least the first product, have a unique value over the first gen robots in the lung. We are able to, see a rapid growth in procedure number and utilization. So these are good signs that we are driving the right, turning the right knobs to drive the growth, and we're going to continue to do more. And strategically, we're certainly making small bets, but those small bets, a lot of them don't turn out to be something meaningful, but we'll never stop trying, and we'll have to figure out the right timing and the right fit for the market.
Wow. So in going against two large players, Intuitive and J&J, it sounds as if the strategy is simply our product is better, it performs better than theirs, and that's why you should buy us. That's the selling point.
Currently, that's been the case, mm-hmm. and it's a great question. I internally, we definitely respect Intuitive and Oris J&J a lot, because we understand both are very successful companies and very powerful when they come to commercialization and things like that. As a startup company, we really wanted to focus on the customers. And the question we ask ourselves is, if there's one customer who's using Galaxy, why this customer gonna use Galaxy more often, or gonna use Galaxy less often? Uh-huh. And the second question that we ask is, if there's a customer who's not using Galaxy yet, what can we do to let them know the Galaxy is a better solution so that they can switch over? So I think internally we start to see some initial signs of success in the adoption of Galaxy and utilization increase. to give you an analogy, I think this is more of a timing where when the first gen iPhone came out, and certainly the early adopters already jumped into iPhone 1 right away. But then internally, we've been asking ourselves and say, how can we get other BlackBerry users to iPhone 2, right? That's the work we're working on. And at the end of the day, you know, customers wanted to pay premium on a better product mm-hmm. and better service. And I certainly think that, you know, we are in the market with, you know, a couple others, but not necessarily we wanted to say compete with them. Rather, we really want to focus on our customers.
Great. And what does the future look like for Noah Medical? Final question. Where do you see things headed? You're reporting, and we don't need to include the news in this, but I know today you reported some positive bronchoscopy data for Galaxy. So you're continuing to put out clinical data, but where is this all headed?
Yeah, you know, personally, I've been observing how the medical device community promote new technologies and how customers buy into new technologies when they show up. I think, you know, a decade ago, physicians and hospitals asked manufacturers to provide clinical data, mm-hmm. and that's almost like you know, the first thing they do when they talk to manufacturers or device providers. I think in the past few years, the thing has definitely changed, and physicians make decisions to switch based on LinkedIn post, and they mm-hmm. also trust a lot of the kind of peers word of mouth. I think that's a shift in general. Like, that's just not for us.
Interesting.
But as a startup company, though, we wanted to build a strong foundation. In other words, we wanted to make sure that we are accountable for the data we produce, and also we're accountable for you know, the value we create. And we also encourage our customers to do independent studies, so that at the end of the day, we still believe that clinical data, especially peer review articles, are the key driver for a proof of new technology is better from clinical perspective. So I think for us, if we continue to invest in the right things, eventually there's going to be a place for Noah to thrive. This may take longer than typical device companies or typical startups in the Valley, but compared to our peers in the medical robot sector, we are still the fastest to clearance from day one, and also still the most capital efficient company so far in the medical robot space. So we are very proud of what we do and how we do it differently than the prior companies.
How did you come up with the name Noah, by the way? It just occurred to me. Where does Noah come from?
All right. This is the fun part.
This will be the last question, but I'm curious.
Great. It's an excellent question, by the way. I told you that when I started Noah, this is my fourth startup and the third one that I found or co-found. And by that time, the name of company doesn't really matter. The analogy would be Apple, right? And who cares if Apple product doesn't work well? But I do care about the brand because their product works the best. So when I started Noah, I remember I was living in San Mateo at that time. And I was sitting downtown San Mateo in the Starbucks. I go there often. And you know, one day I realized I need to register a company so that I can get other things going. I need a name. And then what I did was I was looking around. There's a Noah Bagels right next door to Starbucks. So I said, oh, Noah is actually a good name because people all know about Noah Ark.
Yeah.
And also Noah is a name that, you know, people just knows, right? It's easy. And if you tell them we're Noah Medical, no one's going to spell this wrong. So it's like, okay, let me look it up. And sure enough, you know, Noah Medical is available. So I was like, okay, that's it. So we, you know, spent $500 and registered the company. And Noah Medical is doing well so far. Keep it this way.
That's a great story and a great way to end the conversation, John. Thanks for joining us in the podcast.
Great. Thank you, Tom. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
All right. Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. So grateful to MedMark for joining us on this week's FOMO, great point of view, I think, on the tariffs.
Thanks, of course, to all of you for being part of Device Talks. Make sure you subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network, the Device Talks Podcast Network, or you can subscribe to individual shows on your podcast players. But you don't want to miss any future insights coming forward. We've got a lot of great ones coming out. We talked last week about the launch of Women in MedTech and working on some very cool stuff for 2026. So it's going to be a great year for Device Talks podcasts. Please connect with me on LinkedIn. Connect with Kayleen Brown, our managing editor on LinkedIn. Make sure you follow Device Talks. Also connect with Chris Newmarker of Mass Device and follow Mass Device as well. All right, folks, thanks again for joining us on this episode of Device Talks Weekly.